wish I could break free, back to where I'm supposed to be.
Welcome to the Sickles and Noise podcast on the Pro Sound Web Podcast Network. I'm Chris Leonard, and I brought along a guest host. Y'all may know him, Ryan John, or Ryan O'John. Yeah. Not Ryan apostrophe John O'John. It's just,
You know, John. People who've never met me see my name, and they're expecting to see a red-haired Irish kid. They're like, Ryan, it's got to be O'John. They're like, Ryan O'John, very Irish. And then I show up, and they are very confused.
I'm okay with it. I'm sure. And Kyle may jump in mid-conversation here at some point, but we'll see. But we need to get rolling without him, but that's all good. Sam is out on tour right now with Volbeat. So if you see Volbeat come to town, go see her. So I do have housekeeping. I should acknowledge the fine people who sponsor us. So we should pay some bills, quite frankly. So we want to give a special thanks to Alan Heath for Rational Acoustics and RCF. They are all great partners, not just because they sponsor the podcast, but they all have great products. They have great support. They're good people. We've had all of them at different points of the podcast. So thank you to all three of them. So this week I have on someone I met 9 years ago. I did the math because I saw a Facebook memory come up back in 2015, right? Is that 9 years ago? Something like that.
Sounds about right. Yeah. Wait, that's eight.
I can't do math that quick.
Right now. It's 8 years.
Oh, whatever. Anyway, I went to a training class down in Atlanta, Georgia. It was a SynogCon level 300, which was a phenomenal class. And there was Barbara Adams, who was on the call tonight. She was this freaking radio, the podcast tonight. You'd think after a couple hundred episodes, you'd think I would know how to freaking do this, right? Barbara, and the cool thing was that Barbara is from my, not hometown, where I live. She's in the Philadelphia area. She's done studio work. She's done local club work, festivals, and she has been a not necessarily a adjunct professor or some level of teaching, whatever that, I don't know what the terminology there is, for two different universities, Drexel University, Rowan University. I've had the luxury of being able to, or pleasure, I should say, giving some lectures at her class at Rowan. So you also lead the Philadelphia Sound Girls chapter. And, you know, I think you're pretty well known in the Sound Girls community. So welcome to the show, Barbara.
It is a pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me.
Oh, and if we give it just a second for the bubble to keep going, there he is. Oh, he told me to shush. Kyle's here in the background. He's going to get set up. And but anyway, so Barbara, it's been really fun to kind of get to know you from afar, and then kind of get to work with you education wise. You've done a lot. You've done studio work. You've worked in venues around Philly. Let's do the proverbial. How did you get into the business?
I'll try to keep this short. I got into the business because I loved music. It really stemmed from that. I didn't know anyone in the industry. I did not want to be an artist. I played music and I sang, but I didn't really want to do that on any professional level. But I still wanted to be surrounded by musicians and surrounded by music. So in 11th grade, my mom had gotten me a subscription to Spin magazine. And I was, you know, enthralled with it every, you know, time it came, read it from cover to cover. And back then in magazines, in the very back, there were a whole bunch of ads. And I would literally like go through all of the ads. I don't know why. It was just something I did. And I saw an ad for Full Sail. And it said, learn to be a music producer. And it had probably a picture of a console or it might have even had a person on there at some point. And I was like, what is that? I want to know how to do that. And so, you know, over the next few years, tried to find out what that was on my own and wasn't very successful. You know, I mean, this is back in the late 80s, early 90s. No, it was the late 80s at that point. So, you know, there's no internet. There's no community like there is today.
Mm-hmm.
And so I decided that, you know, Full Sail was where I should be. And it took me a few years to convince my parents of that. But I ended up there and soaked it all in as much as I could while I was in school. And when I graduated, I had no money and had to come home. And, you know, schools back then were training you to work in recording studios. And I liked that side of it. I had one class in live sound, and I liked that a whole lot more. But again, I didn't know anybody in the industry. And since all of my training was to go get an internship at a studio, that's where I started. And it kind of grew from there. Like I, you know, finally got to know people in this area. And I worked at Sonic Recording Studios, which used to be called The Warehouse. They had just turned it into Sonic the year before I got there, I think. And I walked in and was like, hi, I want to intern here. And I did send my resume to like all of the studios in Philadelphia, including Sigma and Studio 4. But Sonic was the only one that got
both of those are iconic studios, by the way. Philadelphia has, you know, a pretty iconic history when it comes to the studio world.
Yeah.
And they got back to you, or you just walked in the door and you're like, hey, now you need to listen.
So they got back to me. I didn't just walk in the door, but you know. And so when I showed up, they were, you know, I think they had probably been operational for maybe 6 months when I first got there. They were still doing wiring for some stuff. And I was like, you know, they're like, well, what do you want to do? And I was like, well, you know, at that point, you know, I'd been trained to, I knew what an internship was going to look like. I knew I was going to be washing dishes, vacuuming floors, cleaning toilets, getting coffee. And so that's what I told them. I was like, I'm here to learn and I'll do anything you need me to do. I quickly moved to an assistant engineer once they figured out that I could actually buy us a tape machine.
Nice.
And got to know the engineers there really well, learned a lot from them. But again, my heart was not in it. Like I didn't feel like I fit in. I fit in. I can't say that I didn't feel like I fit in because I really did. Like it really became my family. But at the same time, I knew in order to like move up, I felt like I was stuck at assistant engineer, that I wasn't gonna really progress from there. And I think a lot of that had to do with the fact that I wasn't a musician. I felt really intimidated. I couldn't tell a musician, I wasn't a producer. I wasn't gonna like tell a musician how to play something, or I could get the sounds. Like, I mean, I knew mic placement. I knew how to do all of that. But it was just that communication with musicians that I just didn't feel like I had that in me. But at the same time, we started doing these radio shows for a local radio station, WDRE, back then. And they would bring in all of the acts that were popular then to do these live performances in front of a small audience. And so I got tasked with doing sound for that small audience. And in the control room, they were recording the whole thing. So we were kind of doing, you know, kind of broadcast recording at that point. And you know, got to know people in the area, started filling in at some of the smaller clubs. And then in 98, 99, somebody asked me if I wanted to do monitors at the Trocadero. And I said, yes. And I left the studio and never looked back.
Kyle, have you ever come through the Trocadero? Oh, you're on mute, or your mic's not working.
But I've been through the truck. I've definitely done gigs.
Have you?
Yeah.
When
yeah,
did I you mean, come through?
Ages ago.
When?
It would have been, I don't know, 2005, 2000.
Oh, yeah, I was gone.
Somewhere in that
window.
I was
out of there by then.
Yeah.
I was only there for a couple of years, and then I moved up to the Electric Factory.
Well, I would have gone through the Electric Factory somewhere in that window, too.
So I was at Electric Factory until 2005. Okay. And then I got burnout and kind of had to get out.
Why is that? Why'd you get burnout at the Electric Factory? I never heard anyone
get burnout
say
in this
such
industry.
A thing.
I know.
Especially at the Electric Factory. It's home of sticky floors and crooked PA, and half of it shoots into a stairs, and there's a lot of hardcore shows there where stuff gets broken. I mean, that's just fun times.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it wasn't much different than the truck, but the interesting part was at that time the bands that I was mixing at the truck were starting to move up to the Electric Factory. So I started seeing the same bands, the same crews,
the same guys, yeah,
which was pretty awesome because, you know, I not to show my ego, but I was good at what I did. And so they came in and they saw me and I was just like, hey, we're going to have fun today. But no, I got
99% sure that I met you at the Electric Factory before you left.
Now, was I miserable? Or was I still? Was
Kyle,
I still?
Okay.
Was I still happy?
No. I'm never miserable. I'm the happiest fucking sound guy ever. The thing, I'll make a generalization, and Chris will hate me for it, but it's true. Most people in Philly are miserable. Yeah. So you quite possibly could have been miserable.
For the record, I'm not from Philly. I live in Philly now. So you can say all you want about Philly.
Okay. Quite possibly you must have been miserable at one point. You lived in Philly.
To move to Philly, yeah. I'm sure we've crossed paths at some point, Kyle.
I love... See, I was born and raised in St. Louis, Missouri, home of no iconic places. So Electric Factory, Chocodero, and those kind of venues were iconic to me. And I think Philly still holds on to that to this day, even with the newer venues that are coming up through there. It's like they're becoming icons of the industry. And I think here's the deal. You'll probably get into it, but Troc and the Electric Factory make you into a good thing. Whatever you did at that venue, you became awesome at it because the duct tape and spit wears off and you have to put your own on, and shows happen there relentlessly and you get beat and you have to deal with bands and people that ask for too much, and then you ask for people that have too little, and you do the best job you can, and you hone your skills more than anyone ever in the entire world, I think. Yeah. And that would be my question to you is, when you started doing these nasty club gigs, as we call them, how much did your learning curve go from where you had came from in a controlled environment in the studio, a controlled environment in your studies? How did that fit in with what you had already brought with you?
How did what I learned before fit in with what I was doing? A lot.
Yeah, with the intensity. Yeah.
A lot. I came from a training environment that, first of all, you know, I don't know what Full Sail is like now. And, you know, I hear so many negative things, which I hate because that's where I got my start. But while I was there, they trained me for the reality. I learned how to solder. I learned how to fix things. I learned how to work exhausted. I mean, at that point, when I was going to Full Sail, we had 8 hours a day, 6 days a week. And wow. It was a 4-hour lecture and then a 4-hour lab. And they weren't back to back all the time. I could have had a 9 a.m. to 1 p.m. lecture and then a 1 a.m. to 5 a.m. lab. Or they could have been, the lecture was at night and the lab was in the morning. You know, it was just all over the place. And it changed every month. It was a different schedule every month. So they really did train me to be exhausted and still function. They trained me to understand signal flow, to be able to find things that are wrong. What was it? Kim called them fault finders, right?
Yeah, fault finding.
You know, I learned how to troubleshoot. And so when I got into those environments, like I knew how to work in that environment. I think what I didn't have the skills for was the people interaction part as much. Mm. Yep. And that's what I had to learn really fast. Put on my game face, which I didn't always do. I definitely became the angry sound guy, not being a guy.
You know,
was that a flight or flight or a defense mechanism, or how did
I think
that?
It was.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, I'm not going to say I didn't see the difference with how people treated me versus a guy, and I internalized all of that anger, and I either shut down and did the whole, like, I'm just not going to talk to you. I'm going to do my job. I never stopped doing my job,
right?
But I just wasn't pleasant about it.
Mm.
And that started to get to me. And it got to the point where actually the production manager at the factory actually pulled me aside and was just like, hey, Barb, people are kind of saying you're being mean. And that was a huge wake-up call. I was like, really? I don't feel like I'm acting any different than anyone else that works here, but okay. And I think a few months later, another job had popped open that was a little less stressful. And I left and did that. Although it wasn't really less stressful. It was just a different kind of stress.
Right.
The grass is never greener.
No. So yeah, I left there and I went to a small club. I went back to the small clubs, and that's kind of like, I kind of skipped over that. I got invited to go work at the truck, but before then I was doing sound in some of the even bar, like what you guys would consider the bar clubs, mm-hmm. You know, 100, 200 capacity rooms. So one of those places that I worked at, early on had opened up a new venue that was like a 450 capacity room. And they'd put in this really nice PA system with a front of house and a monitor console, which was weird for that size venue.
Yeah.
But they were like, hey, Barb, can you come do monitors here? And I was like, perfect timing. Yes, let's do it. And I got back to working with local musicians. And that's what I mean, you know, my passion has been that. My love of that is... Philadelphia has an amazing music scene. And so I got to know so many local musicians. I think always with the thing in my back of my head, like maybe somebody's going to take me out on the road sometime.
Mm.
And it happened a couple times, but it was never, I never did touring full time. So I would, like, I do a van tour. I did one bus tour, and the rest van tours, like short runs. But I was always happy in the clubs. And then, you know, just kept going, and that club closed, which is kind of how I got into teaching. I don't know if you want me to go there yet.
Yeah, I do. Cool. Want you to go there.
Yeah, well, right. It was definitely probably where I was going to go next was, so yeah, yeah. You've yeah. spent, you know, quite some time teaching at this
so
point.
So in yeah. 2008,
actually, you know what, before we go there, I do have a question about where you were coming from there. So I had a really similar path to what you described too. And I remember when being an intern, you're almost taught to be passive. You're not to talk up. You're not to kind of, you know, do these things, right? And then when you go from that to an environment where you do need to have some amount of authority, right? And you need to be the person that someone can come to and they feel confident when you go, this is how we're going to do it. Going from that passive role to that, you know, kind of authoritative position, that's a really challenging path to go between those two, especially if you don't have some guidance, you know, to do that. And it sounds like, you know, you kind of went through the same thing, right? And what did and didn't work for you is that there was a point there where you also got kind of hard and kind of unpleasant, right?
Yeah.
So Do you have any, I don't know, thoughts, tips, or whatever for somebody that might be going from that passive place where, like, I just got out of school, I know I don't know a bunch of stuff, but I need to figure out how to be confident while not being unpleasant. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. It took me years to get there. I don't know.
I mean, I think it takes everyone years to get there.
Yeah.
But I don't know. Maybe I there's a couple little things you can pull out, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I think we all need to be patient with ourselves, right? Like, I think that's the first thing. We all want it all, and we want it now, and it's never going to be that. And so, like, having that patience, but I think also finding a mentor. And that's something that I didn't really have. Mm. I had plenty of people that I trusted that I could have conversations with about technical stuff, but not, I don't think the environment back then was something that I could have some conversation with emotionally, you know? I think we're in a different place now. I think organizations like Sound Girls, has created that. And so I think the best advice I could give to somebody is, if you're going through that, find somebody to have, you know, talk to. And I think hearing those stories kind of helps you through that. I mean, I got a phone call from a student today with a discouraging conversation that it's not my story to share. So I'm not going to share it here, but she was experiencing some things, and I was like, wow, okay. My advice to her was to get out of that situation. But, you know, I also told her, like, you know, I had that conversation, like, how do you feel about it? Like, can you have a conversation with this person? Like, do you feel comfortable having a conversation with this person? And that's something I wish somebody had told me back then. You know, like, if yes. I was like feeling a certain way, like, somebody come up and shake me and be like, hey, let's have a talk, you know?
Yeah.
I understand what you're going through, but, you know, therapy.
Yeah. I love that you said you basically were hardened, because I'm currently on tour. I'm home for a moment, but I'm discussing with some other colleagues about being hard. And I think all of us on the podcast tonight come from that era of where that was like the relevant piece, is like, you had to be hard. And now there is no relevant piece to be hard. Being hard almost shows your inability.
Right.
And I think that's what they need to be taught, is they don't want to speak up. They don't want to be social in action. Like, the passiveness travels through it. And like, I think we can talk about it now, and it might even be teachable. And maybe we can get to that when we get to the education part, is social interaction and getting away from a digital social interaction and actual people interaction, especially when we're on show sites and festivals and stuff like that, and how well you can use that to work for you and not be hard.
Yeah.
Like, I think as far as me growing up helped a lot. Loss of testosterone helped a lot, because I didn't feel the need to be hard anymore.
Right.
Like, I wasn't trying to battle anymore. And that was the first thing that I told the colleagues that I was talking about this week, was, you know, there's a point when you don't have to be hard anymore, and you get a lot more with great communication skills than you do than just being the tough ass. Like, and like you said, that rubs off. You're being in that situation, you inherited those actions because you thought that was correct.
Right.
And it made you not happy with what you're doing. Because we're not those kind of people. Like, we want to help. We're service industry people. We work in the service industry. This is what we do. And if we can't communicate directly without being hard, maybe that's a great thing to address with students, is like, hey man, how do I, as a 20 some year old tour manager, approach a tour manager who's 60 years old to get what I want from my band on a daily basis? Like, yeah. I get those questions all the time, and it's not even, sometimes they're not even audio related, and it's like, well, you just have to be confident what you say, and you have to present it in a way that they want to answer. And I'm glad you said that. Like, people need to quit being hard.
Yeah.
Like, that's what's stopping this industry from being fully legitimate thing is is people still trying to be hard. Like, it drives me insane.
I want to come back to that because I do want to talk a little bit about how I approach that in my teaching.
Perfect.
Well, we're here now, so let's just we can go back to high-end.
Let's go.
Just go. Yeah, go for it.
Okay. So I guess I'm a full-time lecturer for Rowan University, which means I am teaching a full course load, 4 or 5 classes a semester, and then mentoring students in a variety of ways, along with administrative stuff, but won't get into that one. So I teach an intro recording class, which is basically an intro to Pro Tools. I teach my live sound class, which I developed. So I teach that every semester. And then once a year, I have a level 2 sound class, which is what Chris has come as a guest speaker to. And then I have my seniors that are doing capstone projects that I kind of am a mentor more than anything, meet with them. You know, every couple of weeks during a semester while they're working on their year-long project, whatever that is. And students get to choose what that project is. But in my live sound class, the way I got into teaching was I lost that job. The club had closed. I was 3 months pregnant and just settled on my house, my first house. And like world fell out from underneath me and didn't know what I was going to do. And being a woman in this industry, I kind of had it in my mind that nobody was going to hire me, because I was pregnant and I was showing. Ended up not being the case. But as I'm trying to figure out what my next step is, I contacted some friends who were teaching at Drexel University and was like, hey, you know, I'm curious what the program is. It was a new music industry program at Drexel. And so they're telling me about it. And I was like, cool, who's teaching the live sound class? And they're like, oh, we don't have one of those. And I'm like, how do you have a music industry program and not have a live sound class? I don't understand. Like, where are all your students getting jobs? Because at that point, studios were closing. And so they kind of came back to me after the few discussions, like, hey, if you want to develop a class, we'll bring that in as an elective. And so then I was an adjunct. So this course is something that I put together based on my experiences, based on how I learned. And I go through, you know, what is live sound? First of all, that's the first discussion. What does an audio engineer do? So they actually have some sense of, you know, not this glorified vision of what they think it is, but the real job. And you know, we go through all the technical stuff, all the theory stuff, but then at the end of the class, and Kyle, this is kind of where I was going with this, I have a class on how to survive in this industry.
Love it. Love it. Like, I mean, gonna come and take it.
And, you know, I mean, I share stories like what I've experienced, and that particular lecture is more of just a conversation with students. Like, I know I got through my 20s living on Coca-Colas and Snickers bars, you know, and
are you looking at my desk right now?
You know, it's not a healthy choice. It's not a healthy choice. I still
feel attacked.
Snickers bars. No, I'm right there. I wish I had a Coke and a Snickers bar right now, but you know, just the mental things that people go through. We have those conversations, and I think the generation that I'm teaching now understands that more than we did at that age. And so I think it's an easy conversation to have with them. And they ask about, you know, lifestyle. sometimes they'll, you know, how do you manage that work-life balance? And we'll talk about that. And I, you know, I guess the main thing I can say about that is it, every person is different. You have to find out what's right for you. And it, it takes time to figure those things out. And, you know, you kind of brought this up a little while ago, that, that maturity level, right? Like back in my 20s, I was raring to go and didn't think about, you know, how my body was reacting to things or how my mind was reacting to things. It was just, I did what I had to do. And as I got older, I realized, man, I'm exhausted. I can't keep this pace up. And so you kind of slow down, you learn how to do things smarter, not harder. So, yeah.
No, that's super interesting. I mean, yeah, the transition between students and like working is still just like such an interesting thing to see. And having a class like that would have helped a lot of people that were kind of graduating when I started too. I mean, it would have helped me.
Right.
You know, I know that when I was younger and starting out doing this, it was a lot of like information held close to the chest. People were way less willing to share.
Sure.
And we didn't have the resources we do now. Like now there's YouTube full of videos. There's podcasts. Yeah. There's all this other stuff. There's communities, as you had mentioned, and groups, right, that can help you through some of this stuff. I remember one of the things that I thought when I was young was that asking questions meant you didn't know. So you were afraid to ask, right? You just wouldn't ask. You'd be like, oh, they're going to think I'm dumb if I ask about this. So, you know, giving people the confidence to just be like, you know what? It's okay to ask.
Yeah.
And having them ask. That said, though, I do think there are really good ways to ask questions and really bad ways to ask questions.
Right.
And the reason I bring that up is people ask me a lot of stuff. And when they ask a question that doesn't imply knowledge, I don't know how to answer it. Right. Because there's a whole breadth of things I could say. When someone goes, oh, man, the vocal sounds great. How did you do it? I'm like, it's not enough. I'm like, yeah, I put a great singer in front of it. Right.
Right.
but if it's way more specific, like if someone says, okay, the vocal sounds great, you know, the you've got these long reverb tails, but they're not getting in the way of the vocal. Cool. That teaches me that you understand, one, it's reverb. Number two, you understand that reverb plus vocal, it tends to get, you know, muddy, things like that. Like, I now know a lot about what you understand. And subsequently, I actually have a focused answer I can provide. So a thing I wish people starting out can kind of grasp onto better is the more guided your question is, the better quality of an answer you'll get back. And also there's a better understanding of, you know, what you know, what the other person understands that you know, et cetera, all those things, you know?
Yeah, that's great.
Sorry, that wasn't
I'm trying
really
to
question.
Think of like how my students ask questions. Like, I mean, yeah, like I encourage my students to ask questions. I guess one of the other things that I can add is I actually have assignments built into my courses where my students have to go and shadow somebody other than me.
Perfect.
They hear all my stuff.
So they have to find someone to shadow?
Have to find somebody to shadow. And a lot of times I place them. I mean, that's the one great thing about working in Philly for almost 30 years is that I know everyone at all of the clubs. And so I can just kind of pick up the phone and be like, hey, this student wants to come and shadow this show. And sometimes the students actually get to go see shows that they really want to see, which is sometimes not the greatest thing. Because then they're not paying attention.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, they're just being a fan. But I try to get them to a point where they understand some of the fundamentals before they do that, so that they have an understanding of what's going on. But at the same time, I will say that that depends on the student and if they're paying attention. Because let's face it, not all of them are going to be working in this industry when they graduate.
Sure.
No, fair enough. Fair enough.
And there, like you said, there's a different understanding of fan level appreciation opposed to the appreciation of us sitting here. Like, I don't like going to a bar. I don't appreciate sitting in a bar and having a speaker pointed at my head. But fan level appreciation, they love that shit. You know, so it determines a lot of how you talk to them. I love that you take the time to get out of the classroom and show the real life, because even through this podcast and all my friends, Ryan, Chris, Sam, everybody, like, the real appreciation of what you do is the interaction that you have on the show site, because the endorphins that you experience just by stepping in the venue are incredible. Like, so being able to curb your enthusiasm, so to speak, and focus on what you're really there for, and still take all that in is higher than ever fan appreciation and our appreciation, you know, because how many times have you been asked after a show, so what'd you think, man? It sounded great. And you're like, yeah, it was okay.
Yeah. Right.
You know what I mean? So that's the question they need to ask, is why did they just say, oh, it was okay? Because at that level of understanding, like Ryan's Reverb Tales, you don't get why that's so important to the person producing the show, or you know, the production of the show itself. So that's cool that they get to do that. I wish every university that had this kind of program would do, like you said, lifestyles, and get as many people to come in and tell the story, because the generation that's getting this now, they want to hear the stories.
Yeah.
They want to hear the stories. All they saw was their parents going to Motley Crue concerts. You know what I mean? That they were a product of Nikki Sixx or whatever they are. But it's fun to watch them engage when you tell the right story. And there's so many of us out there. Like, I still listen to stories to this day. That's how we interact on tour, is like, we all just tell stories.
Right. There's something to be,
right?
There's something to be learned from. There's definitely something to learn from all of those stories. But, you know, I think the benefit of having, and Chris, I'm going to go to you, because I know you posted this on the Facebook page, you know, the value of education. And I think one of the biggest things is like making sure that students understand that theory, understanding, you know, what pre-delay does. On a reverb, understanding what, you know, what all of these tools do and when and how to use them.
I think the when and how to use them is the harder one.
It is. It is.
And how to write that in a curriculum.
Right. But it comes with experience. Like, I just did a summer camp for high school students. And it's 1 week long, and we're trying to teach them logic. And I get some students that come in that have already been making beats on Logic or FL Studio or whatever.
Shocking,
you know,
right.
put in whatever DAW
insert
that they're
DAW here,
using.
Yeah.
And then I get some students that have no experience, like don't even have a Mac, so they've never played around with GarageBand. You know, they might have had some kind of like band lab thing or something in their high school music class, but that was about it. I take them through, like, okay, this is an EQ, and for that one I actually didn't even, it was a listening experiment. It wasn't even like, before we even pulled up an EQ in Logic, I used Quiztones, which is a fun little app that does like an EQ change on a guitar or a piano, and they have to figure out what frequency that EQ change was at. And so doing those like fun little quizzes for them, fun little tests or whatever, it allows them to kind of listen. And critical listening is one of the biggest things, and you really can't teach that. Like, you can show them, like, you can give them the tools, you can explain stuff to them. I can play music and say, okay, now listen to that. Like, one of the things I do in my live sound class is have them listen to the splay of a speaker. Like, walk around the room. Where do you lose it? Mm-hmm. You know, or put a monitor down in front of them and give them a microphone. I'm like, all right, walk around the stage and tell me where it sounds the best and why that sounds the best. And so it's having them do things. And so then, you know, during camp, after we did that fun experiment with quiz tones, we pulled up an EQ that had them pull up an EQ on something they recorded. And I'm like, play around with it. Listen to it. Listen to what it's doing. Like, really listen to it. And, you know, at the end of the week when they gave me their projects, I looked back and some of them were really smart choices on EQs and some of them were not so smart choices on EQs.
Sounds like an example of okay, guys, we'll just do some ear training to start with.
Yeah.
You know, like, I think that's left out of the equation a lot is ear training and what instruments sound like without reinforcement of any kind, you know?
Right.
And I'm a victim of that as well, because I was a scoop the mids out of the kick drum guy for a really long time until I figured out what a kick drum actually sounds like when you sit behind a kit or whatever the case may be. Like, and I think kids that do beats reference other beats.
Right.
So, it's a great time for like ear training at that point. I would love to see your curriculum. You're saying everything I want to hear right now. Sorry.
I can send you my syllabus.
This is what I aspire to do, because I can only help so many people. You know what I mean? And whether I work at a university or I tour around and go to universities and talk to people, or if I go to AES events and just do that, this is what I want to do. Like, yeah. So it amazes me that you can actually facilitate a curriculum of what we do, because sometimes I stand behind the console and I go into the zone, bro. I'm just gone. Like, it's like magic. Like, my fingers just start moving and things start going together and I can feel it come together. And like you said, you can't write that down. Right. Like, how do you write that down? What made me make that decision? We're always talking about, you know, hey, know what it does before you do it, or try it. But it's like, it's almost a craft like painting. You never know how to blend colors really well until you painted a whole bunch of stuff, or you never develop your own style until you've sold some pieces or whatever. Right. So,
mixing's the same. Yeah, absolutely.
It's just this weird art.
Bad mixes to get to the good ones.
Yeah, man.
Well, Ryan, I'd be curious to hear from you, right? So I know Scovel is really big on, you know, our jobs are literally critical listening is the impetus of our job, right? So Ryan, some of the upper echelon stuff that you get to work on, you know, how would you describe, or how would you teach someone or try to tell someone how to critically listen? How did you learn how to critically listen? Because you wouldn't be where you are doing what you're doing if you didn't do that or know how to do that.
Dear God, that's a hard question to answer.
I know. Right? That's what this podcast is for.
Like 25 years later, like, I guess I just know how to do it right now. Well, fortunately, at least with the stuff I work on nowadays, is I usually have an album to reference, right? Like, someone has just released a record, or maybe it's, you know, 10 years of records. And if I find out I'm going to work for an artist, you know, let's say in 2 months, at least for the month prior to that, I'm just listening to only their records to learn the songs, right? I might even be able to get a set list in advance, so I know roughly what they might play. But beyond even just that, you know how Spotify is really amazing at going like, I don't know, insert artist here, radio, and it'll play all this stuff that is similar to that?
Sure.
You have to understand that the fans that are going to come to your show listen to all those other bands too. Right. And if they listen to all those other bands too, you'll learn that there is a kind of aesthetic to how all of those things kind of come together. Right. The one record you might be listening to, because this is the one we're about to tour on, may somewhat fit into that aesthetic, but maybe it's, I don't know, more modern or more produced or whatever. But if you can understand what the fan base also listens to, that's not just your artist, can also teach you a little bit about what they actually listen for. Like, maybe you find out that in all of these things, there's always a shaker in the chorus or something. And it's like, you wouldn't have really noticed if you're just listening to this one record, but all of a sudden you realize the whole genre, this is just how it is. So you can kind of key on that and you can go, these are the like those little ear candy bits that those people pick out on. So I know I kind of like digressed from what the question is to like learning how to listen.
Nope, that's there.
If you can listen to a huge library of stuff and try and find what's common in between it, you can kind of learn what types of sounds fit for those kinds of things. Does that make sense?
Yeah, 100%.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think just, it's really important. Tons of listening. Sorry, go ahead.
I think it's really important for young people to also understand that you need to listen to different types of music.
Mm.
I think we all come into this with like, I listen to this and the blinders are on for everything else. But, you know, I mean, coming up, my God, I mixed everything from bluegrass to country to hip hop to rock to metal to, you know, whatever, you name it. And so, there's definitely some of those genres that I would not call my favorite at all. But, you know, I got to know those sounds. And I know, you know, from the first moment the band starts playing, I'm like, oh, this is going to be like this. And that kind of guides me as to what I'm going to be doing.
Yeah, especially if you're working in a venue or in a studio.
Right.
You don't get to pick who's going to show up. You don't get to pick the genre.
You're just and that's the thing is, like, At the club level, I mean, I didn't have the benefit of knowing a month in advance what band was coming. Yeah. I mean, I could see the schedule, but like, every day it was something different. And
So. I mean, I have a question for you, Ryan.
Even when I did club gigs, though, I'd be like, "Oh, this is who's coming tonight. Let me just pop on YouTube," because at the time, Spotify wasn't really there, but YouTube, there was just music videos. So I'd be like, okay, let's listen to three songs. Okay, cool, I get it. And then they show up and you just kind of have to go, you know?
I got a question for you, Ryan.
Uh-oh.
What if you spend all this time critical listening and the band that shows up isn't the band, or it was mostly tracks on the album and it doesn't sound like you want it to? Like,
well,
the drummer comes and doesn't have the right... Well, I know that, but you can't really change the aesthetic of a band to fit with tracks. Like, and I do that too. This is how I think about it as well, is like, I kind of go up there and listen to them jam.
Yeah.
Like, that's always a good
Toby Francis, real quick. I just want to plug. So Toby, I posted Toby Francis's article. He's teaching a course at Berkeley, this fall or whatever.
Wow.
And, or like a virtual class for Berkeley. And it's this long article. Please go to our, I don't think I posted it in our Discord, but definitely post it on Facebook. And he talked about, right, so like preparing for the Chili Peppers show or just any tour that he's been doing, right? Like, he spends the first few days of rehearsals just, he's like, screw the console. Don't worry about the console, right? I'll multi-track it. I'll deal with it later, whatever. Like, he just sits in the room and just listens to the experience that's happening and like prints that in his brain, his ears, and then goes to replicate it. So it kind of verifies what you're saying there, Kyle, of like just, you know, actually consuming whatever is there, right? And then going, translating that. And I know this is a luxury. There's a lot of one-off gigs. You don't get to do all this. But just that still, the concept still rings true there. And to piggyback just a little bit earlier, I would argue that in this industry, you will work for more bands that you would have never listened to on a daily basis than the bands that you actually like to listen to.
Oh, absolutely.
Right. So that was something that was very apparent to me early on in my career. It's like, man, almost every tour, I would have never traditionally been my daily listen. Maybe one tour that I did in my whole career was something that I would have traditionally listened growing up or on a daily basis. I may listen to them now because I have an attachment to them. But outside of that, you're going to work with so many different genres or things in this industry that you would otherwise have no association with. So you better learn really quick to appreciate those different arts or music styles or whatever, and also how to work with them.
Yeah, and I wouldn't pass on them either. So if you get offered something that might be a little bit out of your wheelhouse, give it a shot. Like, you got called for a reason, right? So maybe they've heard you, maybe they haven't, but like, give it a shot, man. Like, Barbara, you said bluegrass. I used to mix a band that a guy played thimbles on a washboard and nobody's instrument actually plugged in. And I tell you what.
All around one mic? Yeah.
Bluegrass.
And I had the best time in the world, and it gave me a new love and respect for the music and how it's created and what they want it to be translated like. Like Ryan said, like how to translate that into a big PA that is totally way too enormous for this situation. Like, and the challenge was real, and I loved every second of it, because once you get people dancing on the floor and you get into the pocket, you're like, oh, I get it now. I get it. Like,
but so that in itself is an answer to your question, right? Like, people don't go to a show to hear a perfectly EQ'd kick drum. They don't care if your you know, acoustic guitar has this kind of character to it. They go to feel something, to feel emotion.
Yeah.
And your job is to take the emotion coming from that stage and translate it into everyone in that crowd. So if they're playing and, you know, it doesn't have all the tracks that the record was, when you sit in that room and listen to them play and you go, like, what in this is what's making me feel the emotion? That's what you're trying to capture and make sure everyone else can feel as well. And, you know, to the point of Toby's article, it's exactly the right way to do it. You sit there until you feel it. And when you feel it, you go, oh, this is the thing that's making me feel it. And it's this balance and it's this swing and all that stuff. And it does take a while to understand what that is, you know, to actually listen to music and go, I know why this is making me feel a certain way. That's a long learning process that never ends. Never.
So I start my class, my live sound class. I told you I kind of like started by talking about what live sound is. So my first question to them, like literally their first assignment, is a group assignment where they get together and have to have a discussion about the best concert they ever went to.
Cool.
And
that's awesome.
Why it was the best concert they ever went to. And so it really gets them thinking about, like, you know, the sound, where they were at in the room, who they were with, you know, all of these things that I kind of weave in and out throughout the course then, right? And, you know, I never really thought about that when I first got started. But, you know, my best concerts now are concerts where I get to that point, Kyle, where I'm finally comfortable mixing and have that. Like, I'm into it, and you can see me dancing behind the console, you know?
Guilty.
Like, those are the best.
Me too.
Yeah.
Guilty. And it's nothing to feel guilty about, because that's the part that's hard to teach, is like, why did you do that during the middle of that song? Or why did you change that up? Or why, like, and it's like, you almost lose your mind for a second. And you just go onto automatic pilot and you know what to grab. And like, everyone's like, how do you find anything on that desk? Or how do you find this stuff in your waves rack or whatever? It's like, you know, and it's this weird knowing that gets you to where you go. And I still use vibration a lot. And I think that that's something that can go along with ear training for students as well, as vibration. And there's good vibration and there's bad vibration. And obviously everyone's ear is different, so we all hear different stuff anyways. But what is good vibration, you know, for your body? And I think moving the crowd or purveying that information to people is that vibration, and how it's all put together. Like, and that's where like great system engineers come in, great PA distribution comes in, because then it makes it makes your canvas even better. Like, you went from a cheap $5 canvas to this $1,000 piece of skin from like an alien from 1935 or whatever. Like, it's like you can finally paint the picture that you want. And I think
you describe it like that, like the whole paint the paint reference.
I think all of us have a sonic signature. You know, I've been following Ryan for a long time. We came up in the same era. Like, I know how Ryan mixes, and I could probably almost walk up to a show and go, oh shit, is Ryan here?
Yeah, like, snare drum's and, too loud. Wow. It's definitely Ryan.
So it's like, it's a really cool sonic signature. And I think the talents of the audio person that you're technically given the ability to do this is going to be honed into this artistic skill. And that's why they're going to be recruited to do what they do, along with the people skills and the lifestyle and stuff that we've talked about before, is all like this conglomerate. It has to be in a perfect world, perfect storm. Sometimes it's just not a fit. You know what I mean? Sometimes your picture just doesn't fit, and you figured that out real quick. And I think we described it on a podcast as sometimes you leave tour and you're like, thank God this is over. And then sometimes you leave tour and you're like, man, I still want to text on the group chat and and hang out. Like, that's how we describe that feeling. Like, that's why I love your job so much as an educator, because translating that to an agenda that you have to teach and meet requirements and meet goals, it's like so hard, because they don't think of audio that we do as an art. It's still this technical ability, and there's still goals that you have to hit with technical ability before you can purvey that art. And I don't want it to be washed away. Like, quit taking away my art from what this job entails, because that's what makes me, I think it makes me good, is like, I paint my picture. Like, if you don't like my picture, I get it, but if you like it, hire me.
I want to go back just a little bit about that feeling too, and why you make those moves in the middle of a show. And another thing that's like really hard to teach is that anticipation. And knowing what's coming, even when you don't even know the band, right? Like, if you're dialed into that band, if there's a band on stage and you might have never heard their music before, or you know, you're not familiar with their songs at all, if you really dial into that show and you're focused on it, you know when certain things are going to happen. Like, you feel it before it actually comes. Being on top of those and being able to make those moves quickly as soon as you hear it, like, that's another thing too, right? Like, it's...
Absolutely. I think that's one that I think just has to come with time. You know, just be like, and this goes to even like corporate, broadcast, whatever. Like, there's a certain element of just understanding things that are often more outside of the scope of what you're doing, right? And not living in blinders, and just knowing that, like, all the parts that make up the sum of the whole of what a production is, and being a part of all of that, some of that takes some time of experiencing those things and know what is going to be the moment. And like, specifically, I would say actually is the art of transitions and knowing how to handle transitions, because you're still curating an experience through transitions. And yes, a lot of that revolves around the band. However, the way we as behind the scenes people help move those processes along, everything from lighting to video to audio, whatever, almost all of that relies on anticipation and knowing where it's going, and curating that space. That takes some time, but just like awareness of everything. So
I love that you called it anticipation, Chris, and I love that you included theater and broadcast and corporate and everything, because that anticipation is going to get you your next job too.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Especially, you know, that anticipation or knowing what to do next is going to get you a few jobs probably.
Yeah.
I'm glad that you put that's a great way to put it. Holy cow. Yeah.
You know, what's interesting is that often the client doesn't actually realize you are doing that until they go to someone that doesn't do that.
That's like, very true.
Well, before, you know, if I needed something, it was just always there. It was always there. Like, why don't we have that now? It's interesting stuff.
All right, I'm personally up against the clocks. I apologize. So I'm gonna quick get to a few questions before we have to wrap this thing up. I apologize, because we could probably stay here for a long period. But I want to quickly hit on. I had an experience, speaking of experiences, while teaching or speaking, I would say, at one of Barbara's classes or whatever. So each year I've kind of come in and kind of given a lecture towards the end of the year. I might give a demo on SMART or something like that, just to kind of like, you know, just exposure to something. And so specifically this last time I was like, you know what? I don't really want to teach a specific skill. Like, I want to talk about like all the different paths in our industry and some of these social skills that we're talking about, networking skills, all those things. Right. So, but I had this moment in the middle of while speaking of, us as a community, as an industry, you know, we are typically ahead of the curve in terms of progress, in terms of inclusivity, and just caring about different things. And I found myself literally like having this like war in my head as I'm, and it felt like 20 minutes, but it was like with a matter of seconds of describing how to describe cables. Right. So this is maybe a controversial thing, quite frankly, or people may not want to go here, but I kind of want to at least open this space up for a minute. And I was like, well, shit, do I say male and female XLR? Or talking about like, do you know which end of a cable is and things like that? Yeah. And like, I'm like, literally, I didn't know what to say. And I'm like, I don't know how it actually came out, to be quite frank. I think I might have said male and female XLR. I'm not sure. Yeah. Right. But I'm like staring at, and mind you, like, I'm like, man, it's been 20 years since I've been in school, right? I'm like, I'm now definitely feeling like the old dude up here on stage. And I'm like, anyway, all that to be said, like, so Barbara and I had a conversation afterwards. I'm like, man, okay, whether this needs to be an industry-wide thing, not sure, right? This is probably part of a bigger conversation, but I was like, hey, how are schools handling this? How are you guys handling some terminology that, quite frankly, whether people like it or not, this is something we need to talk about in terms of, do we maybe need to change some terminology? And actually, so I plan on maybe talking about this a little bit more elsewhere, and I posted this in our Discord right before this discussion. Someone sent me a link of the USSIT document that they're working on that has like 20 pages, 30-some pages of terminology across the industry, way more than male, female, XLR, or whatever. I mean, so anyway, that to wrap up. Barbara, can you describe to me some of the conversation you would have with me, maybe how your class and stuff has maybe talked about some of this terminology and dealt with this a little bit?
Yeah, so I actually have to give credit to our studio manager and one of our adjunct professors, Jeff Hyatt, who actually came to me, I think it was even pre-COVID, that we had this conversation about how we are naming things. And it's not just cables, because in recording we have masters and slaves. Mm. And that's not politically correct anymore.
Right.
And so we have decided as a department to, with XLRs, plug and socket, rather than male and female. But when I'm teaching and I start talking about cables, I preface it by saying, guys, I've been calling it male and female cables for 30 years. I am going to
just erase that
and
yeah.
call it.
Yeah.
But, you know, this is the direction that we're moving in. And so, yeah, I think there is a shift. I don't think it's going to be, you know, it's definitely not overnight. I mean, obviously, we've been doing it for a few years now at Rowan, but, you know, I think the next generation is just way more aware of how we name things. You sent me that document a little while ago, and I just looked through it and was like, wow, that's a lot of terms that we need to change.
Yeah,
absolutely. Know, like, just down to like our dress, like how we dress for shows. They're show blacks, but no, that's on that list as that's not going to be, you
or
know, changing.
Using the term using the term blacklist, right? Typically to like cut someone from a show or not using, like, there's just, I mean, so anyway, this is like a tipping of the iceberg of like maybe having some more of these conversations, but it was a very weird experience, but it was very eye opening, and it helped gut check me of like, hey, you know what? This is things that we, you know, regardless of, you know, what we, you know, maybe currently believe, been taught, how we've raised, all those things, we need to have these conversations and think about things a little differently.
Yeah, I think.
But what if it's just an inanimate object? That's weird to me.
I get it. It's, but
your
it's,
mic's
it is, it
Kyle,
is,
Kyle, your
it
mic
is,
cable's sketchy.
Yeah.
There you go. You're back.
Yeah.
Soccer. It is gendered though. Like, I mean, and that's the thing is,
but the mic doesn't care.
The people who are using the mic care.
Yes.
I just don't get it. I'm too old for this.
That's okay.
But just a little thing. So in my camp this summer, I had that conversation with students, and we were talking about XLRs, and I handed them all XLRs, and they were learning how to plug a microphone into a Scarlett. And I had said, you know, there are two ends, plug and socket. I'm just letting you know that, you know, for years, this has been known as male and female ends of the cable. And these are high school students. So, of course, there were a couple chuckles. And one kid in the back was like, well, that's just sexist. And I'm like, okay.
I hope fart jokes never become offensive. Everybody farts still. We could just call them...
Oh, man.
But yeah, there's, you know, I think... You know, certain people are going to keep doing things the way they do them and calling things the way they call them. But there is a generation of techs coming up that look at the world a lot differently than we do.
Yep.
And I think we need to be respectful of that and mindful of that as well.
Yeah. I mean, if we expect them to respect us, then we should respect them as well. Right.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. I'm up against the proverbial clock. I apologize. So, I'm going to just jump to the two questions, that we typically do at the end here. What's something you know now that you wish you knew when you first started? And if you could define your legacy, how would you define that?
Something I wish I had known when I first started. I think this goes back to our earlier conversation. I wish I knew how to handle anger, how to handle insecurity too. I mean, you know, definitely had imposter syndrome, but like,
hey, I still
at the same time I was confident, but you know, so just understanding how to deal with all of that back then, you know, to tell myself, be patient, you're going to get there. And how I want to be remembered, what's my legacy? I guess there's two sides of me for this, because as an educator, I want to be remembered as somebody who inspired them. And I feel like I've done that countless times. I mean, it was one of the biggest, biggest things for me that I value as an educator is watching my students succeed in this industry. And, you know, since I've been teaching since 2010, I've got students that are out on tours, that are working for major production companies, that are working in the clubs, that are doing, you know, and not just live sound. Like, I mean, because I teach recording and our program is tech and business. So we have a lot of students that do just the business side. So we've got students that are, you know, working in A&R and marketing. And so seeing them succeed is the best thing in the world. And so like, I want that legacy to be that I inspired something in them to continue in this career. As an engineer, that I continue to deliver shows that move people.
Love it.
For as long as I can.
That's awesome. Well, I want to say, you know, I'm a student of yours, but you've inspired me from the passion and what you're trying to do. So you are inspiring other people who not necessarily maybe your students, but, you know, just by being who you are is inspiring, I believe. People see that. So I thank you for that.
Thank you. Appreciate that.
Awesome. Well, thank you.
I love that
for...
you can write this stuff down into syllabuses. Holy cow. I couldn't do that. You're inspiring me because I think this generation, like you said, you came from Full Sail where it was a little bit different than the way things are being taught now. And we've settled down into like almost a format of how we get kids out into the industry through this, or young adults, or probably can't say kids anymore. Sorry. How we get them out in the industry. So for you to take that to the next level, I think that's awesome because someone's going to tell your story and that's part of the legacy is like one of your students is going to tell Barbara's story and You did it. That's awesome.
I'll continue to do it.
Awesome. Yeah. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Absolute pleasure to chat with you.
Yeah, this has been awesome.